He was a U.S. Special Forces soldier who was born in Iraq and came to America, enlisted, became part of our U.S. Army Special Forces, and was working in intelligence analysis and translations, interrogations in Baghdad. In 2005, after 2 days of working in Baghdad, he came back through the U.S. Inspection point and took his gun out of the holster, relaxed after going through the inspection point. And as he was relaxing, his car was shot by the car, by somebody in the car in front of him. And it was a U.S. private contractor. And so his story is quite interesting because it sort of symbolizes his life, his dream of becoming a Special Forces officer, his passion, his love of this country, and his passion for defending it and being part of its defense and security, and then being shot by a U.S. private contractor was very symbolic, and it was a way of, his life sort of went downhill, and he didn't die, but he struggled tremendously and, of course, lost his career dream. And while the industry was soaring, it occurred in 2005. And so it's a way to, which you do in narrative nonfiction, and which I've want to do and did do in this book, which is to put a human face on the story, so that people can understand that there is a human cost and a potential collateral damage in privatizing defense and security, just to awaken people to the questions of accountability, monitoring, and transparency, and rules of engagement, consistency, and things like that. So Kadeem is interwoven in the book, and his struggle to get his life back, basically, is told in the book as one of the stories. There are several individuals profiled in the book.
The book is called Invisible Soldiers, How America Outsourced Our Security. Ann Hagedorn is the author. You tell a detailed narrative of not just people, but of the progression of the companies. And you look at this from a little bit different perspective than anything I've seen on it before. You look at this as an industry and analyze it as an industry rather than from a policy perspective or trying to determine, is this good or evil? You're looking at it from an industrial perspective and almost an economic and policy-making perspective, should we or shouldn't we, and trying to help the reader determine that. Why did you want to look at this issue that way rather than the way that most people have thought about this issue since it came onto our radar screens during the Iraq War?
Well, for several reasons. For one, it's my job as a journalist to find out the truth and to deliver it to as many people as possible in a very accessible style. And so it's my dedication as a journalist, I guess. And because it is a vast and complex industry and topic, I felt very obligated to do this. And I don't to dwell on the issues, the people for the industry, the people against the industry. There are people who would like to ban it, who completely believe it's immoral. There are people who want to devise international monitors. Those are the middle ground. And then they're the ones who really believe that these companies can promote peace, can help to end conflict, even though they make a living from conflict. So you have all these points of view, and it seemed to me the most important thing as a journalist was to deliver a story, a narrative that showed how it happened, and that helps future historians. And plus, it's a fascinating story. It's a military story. It's a business story. And then also be fair and get on the inside of each of these arenas And that way, I'm delivering something to the general public, to the citizens of a democracy, so that it can be discussed intelligently and good decisions can be made on the part of government for better transparency and certainly better accountability for this industry as we go forward.
A lot of people think of these companies and the people that they employ as mercenaries. Is that fair? Is that too simplistic? Is that accurate? And if so, or if not, why or why not?
I think it's too simplistic, quite frankly. I mean, I think these companies, you have to look at the vast array of services, armed and unarmed, that these companies provide. Some are focused on armed services. Some are like department stores of defense and security and offer both unarmed and armed. The definition of a mercenary, in my opinion, and is that this is an individual, a hired gun. Of course, our image is of the unsavory characters who organized coups in post-colonial and neo-colonial conflicts, especially in Africa. But this, what we're looking at now, is fundamentally different. The critical factor is that these are modern corporate business forms. They're hierarchically organized into, incorporated and registered businesses. They trade and compete internationally. They recruit worldwide. And they link to outside financial holdings, have astute boards of directors. And like I said, they have wide ranges of services, and also they accommodate to many, many markets worldwide, from the shipping industry to the UN to multinational corporations that are trying to develop in hostile environments, to nations, including, of course, the United States. And we basically gave them their boost in the Iraq War. I mean, we used them in Bosnia, but we have never used them to the extent that we did in the Iraq War, the bonanza of U.S. contracts and that. Excuse me. We gave them a tremendous boost then, and now they are a bona fide industry.
The question of transparency, you've used that word several times in our conversation already, Anne. Are the companies providing the level of transparency that they're required to, or is that the issue, that nobody has asked them to provide the level of transparency that some observers believe that they should?
That's an excellent question. It's both, really. It's mostly that the demands for transparency are not up to the need for transparency. And there are groups worldwide. In the book, I go into detail in this group in Geneva that's been working on this internationally for the armed sector of this industry. They've been working on it since 2006, actually, an international code of conduct and enforcement of that. But it's examples of the need for transparency would be our need as citizens of a democracy to know the full impact of war. So if the government announces casualties in Iraq or casualties in Afghanistan, why not include contractor casualties, which we never have? And between spring of 2009 and spring of 2011, the number of contractor casualties in Iraq exceeded traditional military. There were more private contractor MIAs in Iraq than hugely more than traditional military. And to embrace the full impact of war is to, in your own nation, is to stay connected to the defense of your nation so that you know when to protest it or, support your defense. And if you're part of it, then it's part of your allegiance to your nation to be aware of who is defending it and securing it.
You write about a hearing of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee in the fall of 2011. At that point in time, very little in united members of Congress of each party about what was going on with the world of private military security contractors. However, you identified one issue here, and that is the issue of how the subs were treating their employees and how much the primes seemed to care about it. What happened in that hearing that day that you believe, from what you write in the book, crystallized that relationship and how much or little attention overseers were paying to it, Anne?
Well, I find that hearing one of the most fascinating of the hearings that I include in the book and read about, because I would say the most invisible part of the invisible soldiers concept are the subcontractors. And that's not just invisible to us as to the general public, but also because the general public believes that, of course, that a U.S. contract is a U.S. contract and it's all workers that are possibly getting paid more than traditional government workers, traditional military, when in fact a U.S. contract to Iraq or Afghanistan could be have 4 to 5 layers of subcontractors. And this is one of the main issues of accountability, of course, because who are these subcontractors? Who trained them? How are they vetted? What are their requirements? What are the language requirements if they come from the third world countries? What is the level of the quality and of these workers that we are subcontracting to? And so part of that issue is also, how are the contractors treated? How are the workers in this industry treated? And Congress addressed this, as Francis just said, in the fall of 2011. And there was fascinating testimony that revealed tens of thousands of workers hired by private military and security companies as subcontractors for very low wages from third world nations, particularly in Africa. Some lived in wretched housing, including barbed wire compounds on U.S. bases, and some had no insurance, no health care benefits. By the way, this is one of the reasons it's very hard to get statistics on contractor casualties, wounds, and deaths, because some of these workers don't know to apply for insurance claims. And that's the way the government tracks the statistics on contractor casualties. Some had no access to medical services. Worse still, there were some who were victims of sexual assault. Both parties came together on this, and I'll give you, if you want, Francis, a couple quotes
please.
From it. Representative Gerald Conley, a Virginia Democrat, said, quote, "Not a single case of human trafficking, sexual assault, wage theft, or related crimes has been prosecuted by the Department of Justice. Neither the Army and Air Force Exchange Service nor any other component of DOD or the State Department has suspended or debarred a single federal contractor for such abuses, even though they are routine," unquote. Also, we heard from Republican James Lankford from Oklahoma. "These labor practices violate every human value that we have as a country. Our departments of state and defense stand up and fight for human rights around the globe, but have turned a blind eye to these foreign workers. We believe that all men and women are created equal, and the United States must not stand by idly as these injustices occur on a daily basis."
So those quotes speak to the invisibility that you mentioned a moment ago, Anne. That invisibility, do we have a sense of what drives that? Is it back to the kind of the transparency issue that we talked about in the first part of our conversation? Or is it that the Defense Department, the government as a whole, is not requiring the primes to report this information? Are the subs not required to? I guess that's the issue, is who's not giving who the information that we would like to know now in hindsight?
Well, that's something we really don't know. And that's something really that should be investigated. And that's one of the points in writing that my book is to bring these issues to the surface so there can be discourse, there can be debates, there can be discussions on how to make that information available. Could be a change in the processing of contracts, a change in the requirements of contracts. Maybe the subcontracting requirements are not the same as the general contracts, and maybe each contract changes. But the point is that you can't answer that question, because there needs to be an investigation, a further investigation. In fact, I've always been kind of waiting in coming out of this investigation from the fall of 2011 for another one that would analyze exactly what we do know about the requirements of the U.S. contracts in terms of the information that is given to the government about the subcontracts and the subcontractors.